Can you hear me, by the way? I'm at a Joe in the Juice. I don't have
Yeah.
Wi-Fi at home, so
Yeah,
I'm
you're
not at
good.
my office. Quest, Mike Crumpler, and that other guy, Josh.
Off camera, Matthew was just like telling us that he like grew up in Bethlehem, but and we like both grew up the like Bucks County, Montgomery County suburbs. But I was like really curious about that because I was curious like about the draw of New York in that way. Especially coming from a place where it would be just like more convenient to go to Philadelphia. And I know you've also talked in other interviews a lot about your kind of transition to becoming like a more well-established artist, but I would still also love just a timeline of your career leading up to now, just for like anyone who doesn't know you super well.
I grew up in Bethlehem, which is, yeah, like a really normal place, like 80,000 people, suburbs around the town, which probably are another like 40,000 people. So it's not tiny, but it's not big. And it's colonial, but also industrial and suburban, but it's also urban. So it's, and there are a lot of like layers of American history. And it does, like, as a teenager and as an adolescent, you don't really feel the need to leave because it's pretty. I didn't feel like I wasn't someone who was widely curious about the rest of the world growing up. Like, go to sleepovers, play Madden, play sports. I like to read, I read, and I like put all my, and I wrote music and I wrote a lot, but it was like a completely secret life, which I hid from.
Madden is funny. I feel like that's a Pennsylvania suburbs classic.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There were like Halo kids. My Halo guy played poker. I ran around a lot, you know, manhunt and
Oh my God, Manhunt.
go into the pool in
Yeah,
the summers. And yeah, it was like a really normal, happy childhood, all things considered. I think I've written about this in various places, but there were like seeds of a darker turn in like American life. I think there was a decline in like the overall economic health of the suburbs and the like spiritual health of the suburbs after 2008.
yeah.
Which, but I left, I graduated in 2007. So yeah, in a way, I think I was like in many, many ways, my era. I was born in 1989. Like, you know, Taylor Swift's
Yeah,
Pennsylvania.
I was gonna
I knew what you're
say,
saying. I
yeah.
knew what you're saying. Yeah. It
Yeah.
was very much the end. It was a, I won't call it a golden age because it wasn't a golden age, but it was an age that I think I was the last, or the beginning of the end, or the be end of the beginning. But I guess the reason I'm framing it this way is it was a hyper normal upbringing, like culturally. And it wasn't metropolitan. It wasn't a Whit Stillman movie. I live on the Upper East Side now, but it wasn't anything like what my friends born at the same time, but who went to school uptown or in Brownstone, Brooklyn would have experienced, or even in yeah, other kind of elite parts of the world or the country. So yeah, it was like a non-elite place where like the highest expectation for someone is that they could become a doctor, a professor, work for a nonprofit or something. Nothing, not a ton of ambition. And with there was a kind of expectation that to be too pretentious or to read or to watch Criterion movies was pretentious,
Yeah.
and there was definitely an invisible fence around cultural ambition. And the group of people that I grew up with that wanted to break through that fence was pretty tiny, and very few of them kind of made it past the first electric shock. So yeah, to have made it to New York and just have survived in New York, it's not an accomplishment, but it's not like a great accomplishment in the sense that there's nothing heroic about that, but it takes a certain amount of concentration and determination because one's programming is to revert to yeah, Madden and chill. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
there's nothing, I also want to say that there's nothing wrong with that at all. Like I'm really happy that I can watch a football game, like as I often do. Like that I can play sports, and that I do like to, I can relax in a certain way, and I have a nice family to go back, like a nice home to go back to. And but yeah, there's going to be an incongruence between what my there was an incongruence between what my own like deepest impulses and desires were, and what I grew up doing and I'm learning.
Yeah, I think that like seeing like when we looked you up that that was kind of your background was really nice because I feel like it's something we both can relate to, obviously. And also just seeing that you've like
I bet,
accomplished a
yeah.
lot, like you've been written about in the New York Times, which is super cool, is really nice. It's always like just nice seeing someone kind of go for the same thing that you want, like leave the place that you kind of grew up in, even though it like was a technically different place, but it kind of has the same aura around it, which I think is
Yeah,
really
no, I
cool.
mean, trust me, Bucks County and Lehigh Valley are they're next to each other,
Yeah.
literally, and also so. But I also like, I guess I look younger than I am, and so I think a lot of people think I'm like this savant who just, because I do just like look younger, I think, for the most part, and so I think people think I made it faster, and I haven't really made it in certain economic ways, but
I mean,
if I
you are
if,
definitely accomplished, though. Like,
yeah,
it's not,
accomplished, yes, accomplished, but not accomplished, yeah, for sure.
Well, how old are
I'll
you now?
35.
35, okay.
So I graduated in 2011 from college. So I mean, that's like a long, if I looked a little bit more grizzled, I think it would be a little bit more obvious that it was a, it's t it took till I was, I mean, I was in the time featured in the Times when I was 33.
Yeah, I mean, regardless, I think
I,
that's like a cool thing. Some people don't ever do that, you know? So,
I
still
totally.
feel like
Yes,
it's
yes, yes.
very young. Like,
Yeah, no,
it's
it definitely weird.
is.
No, I guess I, yeah, I guess so. Maybe that's the thing, is from the inside, it feels like a really, like 11 or 12 years of hustling is a long time. And it's
No,
11
that
or
makes
12 years of
sense.
kind of being ignored or being dismissed or being the fly on the, like the meme guy on against the wall at the party who's like, they don't know that I'm talented, and so yeah, there's, I think the external clock is, I'm sure when I was 17 or 18 and like reading about a writer, a book party or something, or like when I went to Syracuse, there was a big, the I was friends with some of the MFA students, and they had a lot of them would be taking the train Amtrak to New York and going to literary parties, and that seemed like unbelievably cool to me at the time. I probably would have thought that, oh, if I could make it by 30 or 35, you know, anything would have been good enough to me. I don't know what my expectations were, but the real day-to-day persistence is like hard in real, in my actual experience in New York was so much harder than I imagined it would be. But
Oh,
being from
yeah.
Bethlehem, the flip side of that is like being able to go home, literally just go home on the bus when I'm having a bad day or be or a bad month or a bad year, helps me. I think if I had to go back to California, I don't know if I would have come back. I think a lot of, I think Bethlehem is a perfect place to launch to New York from because it isn't connected to New York in any real way, but it is physically quite close. And so it's like you can truly leave the New York bubble and go to another incubator, or you can incubate and return.
You feel that way too, just like going from even like our hometowns to Philly, but then also from Philly to New
Yeah,
York.
it's really New York for
It's
sure.
just like, yeah, because it's very easy to get to, and it does feel like you're just leaving this one world, entering a new world, which is nice when you're just kind of fed up with one of the or the other. Yeah. I did also want to ask you about, because I think this is something we're going to get into a little bit later, especially just like talking about like the whole like Dime Square topic and your play and everything. I did want to ask, like, growing up in Bethlehem, did you feel like involved like politically at all? Because I feel like then there's this kind of like, I am interested in that because of kind of where things are at now currently.
I think Bethlehem was a democratic town. It's a steel town, so there was no real, there was a, well, I would say for the most part, people ran from class identity because I think the generation that I was from, as I've also written about in other places, was seeking to escape class. I mean, the early 2000s in general were, 90s, 2000s were a big time of post-history declassification in certain ways. I think so many of my friends were the grandchildren of steel workers, but nobody really had much of a sense of what that meant politically, other than it's nice that we didn't have to work in steel mills. And if someone did have to go back into the working class, that was okay, but also something that you weren't supposed to do. And so I think that inculcated a certain generic progressivism, but just like you could go from being a Clinton Democrat to an Obama Democrat without much thought, and then from Clinton to or Obama to Clinton to whatever else. I think that at least as a teenager and as a college student, there wasn't much thought about politics. It was you're just a Democrat. I think it, and then there was the exurbs and the farm, like kind of hunter territory and farmer territory outside of Bethlehem, which coded a very different way. And you'd meet kids like that from that life world through sports. From like, for at least for me, it was like there was a real difference between the town Democrats and the like exurb Republicans. And this is all just what people's parents voted for, but there were some ten always some tension. But I mean, my adolescence was the Bush years, and that was a totally different. I mean, things were off that those things, Republican and Democrat, also meant radically different. In my opinion, meant radically different things. So yeah, there was a valence of politics, but nobody really thought too much about it. You did what your parents did for the most for the most part. And I think American politics was just a lot like for teenagers in a place like Bethlehem was pretty tame. There wasn't much. It wasn't hyper political, I think, is the larger picture.
Yeah, I was super curious just because like being in like a, as we said, like a similar place, I feel like then made me more political in a way because I was like, okay, this is like, this feels really like stuck. Like people don't really care. And then it made me, I think, a little bit more radicalized. So I was curious if that was a little bit of your experience at all.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think maybe there was a period where I thought of myself as being better than like sort of the generic what I perceived as the generic politics of my Lehigh Valley. But then I think I've also disavowed my, let's say, like my 2016 very generic Bernie bro self, or my very like even my 2012 very generic Obama bro self. I've learned that the texture of, I also kind of believe that there's a giant centric, right now at least, I think there's a giant centrism that a lot of people, that's invisible to people. I think most people actually, when you take, not, this is not particularly profound, but when you take away labels, people, there's a lot that people agree on. And I think I was just listening to a John Fetterman interview before this, maybe in preparation for this interview, because I knew we talked about Pennsylvania, but he's said like Pennsylvania voters don't think of themselves as fascists or progressives for the most part. I mean, and I think that's true, and I think that's good. And there was a time when I didn't think that was good, but I in my current incarnation, I think there's a lot of like wisdom in people who are just living and just who aren't hyper political. So yeah, I think maybe the most I'll say about that is that I think I acknowledge that there's a tension between inside and outside one's home and hometown and home politics. And I've learned a lot from the dialectic. I've learned a lot from going back and forth. I've learned about myself from stepping inside and outside of my own political, native political context.
Yeah, mentioning like 2016, and even 2012 is so interesting because I feel like the difference between 2024 and 2016, like over the past like 8 years, the shift that's happened is just such an interesting thing to look at and just like see how it's kind of like transformed, being exacerbated by obviously the internet and then also like COVID and everything, like all these different factors playing into it. I know you mentioned like hustling in those first like years coming to New York and stuff, but I wanted to ask if you could kind of paint a picture of like what those first years looked like and how you kind of started to immerse yourself into the Dime Square scene and like how like starting to write plays and just kind of what that journey looked like.
I moved to New York without a plan, and I didn't have a plan. I found a very cheap place to live, and at the time, I
Where were you
split.
living?
in deep into Bushwick at a time when it wasn't, the neighborhood wasn't gentrified, which is like very hard to, or it was very lightly gentrified, and that's I think very hard to process about Bushwick. But it was, the most I'll say is it was hard to convince people to go to house parties at our house. And then by the end of the first year we were there, all of a sudden there were parties happening on the rooftops, like next to our apartment. And we're like, oh, things have, sh and they were Brown graduates. And we're like, okay, things have shifted. So I think it was the last year where Bushwick was the frontier. And then pretty quickly after that, it became not frontier. But yeah, it was like $400 a month. I was a debate, I got a job as a debate coach, and I was working part time at a quick, like soon to be defunct literary magazine, that this rich guy had started, that they published my poems, and then they hired me again for like laughably little money, but at the time it felt like enough, and it was sort of enough. And I had a laptop, like an old MacBook, not a MacBook, an old like Windows laptop, and a flip phone, which I still have flip phones. But I would like things that I'm jealous of, like I would spend whole days without my phone. I just spent a lot of time in books. I wasn't working that much. My job required me to work like 2 or 3 days a week, and I just didn't spend any money. Like, I don't know, it's a totally lost way of life. Like, I really didn't need to spend much money. I didn't spend much money. I don't think I ordered a cab or paid for a cab till I was 27 or 28. I mean, I could learn a lot from my younger self, or and many of the things that I have now that I wanted then, but really would walk around New York all day and try to meet people, try to meet girls in bookstores, and
Yeah, that's awesome.
yeah, total. I mean, this is 12 or 13, 13 years ago. So yeah, totally lost way of life. I think the world changed really quickly. I think 2010, 2011 were really, I guess I'm realizing this, it was the end of something. I guess people had phones, but phones, apps, the App Store was a 20, selfies and app, the App Store were like 2011, 2012. So I think we forget this, but the first smartphones were just like better flip phones in certain ways. They were light phones, but phones didn't really transform the texture of life until 2012, 2013. I remember going to an election party in 2012 where someone's like, I have this thing called Tinder. My friend was like, I'm using Tinder. It's great. You should try it. At the time, I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. But
I'm going to bookstores to meet
I'm
girls.
going to
That is
bookstores. I need
not a
Tinder.
story about. Yeah, it was very romantic. It was very, very romantic. And but in some ways, callow. I don't know. I didn't. Ha I had a kind of. I had a cartoonish vision of a lot of things. I admire aspects of my younger self, and aspects of my younger self I don't admire at all. Maybe, yeah, it was, well, I was, it's Don Quixote. I was living a life through book, like through what I perceived New York to be, but I myself was in some ways deluded and naive. But
That's really interesting because I think a lot of now the whole aura around like the online talk around Times Square, I think is kind of comparable to that. Like the feeling you're describing, because I think there's been this online community that's really loved watching this social scene. And I think it relates a lot to just like you saying, oh, I was kind of like eluding myself of this like idea of New York a little bit, I
yeah,
think
no,
is
absolutely.
definitely what people do about New York and just about like the promise of what that leads to of like celebrity of this like interesting social scene that like isn't present in their day to day, I think is a really interesting thing. And I was also curious about you like immersing yourself in that and how you feel about like the online perception of that versus what the reality is.
The online perception of like contemporary downtown and like getting into the Dime Square scene, or yeah. Well, I think what Dime Square is, oh God, no, terrible. No, I got to, can't blame myself for that one.
Well, also, where along this did you write the play
Yeah, I
too?
wrote it in 2021, and I really wasn't even meaningfully a part of it till after I wrote the play. As I think I've also written essays about this, but I wasn't a part of it. I was just kind of constructing something from the outside. And I think there was some hostility towards the idea that someone would be doing this from the outside. But then once I wrote it, I was sort of invited in, invited to parties, considered to be a central part of this whole thing, which I didn't consider myself to be a central part of. But then over time, I just kind of accepted that that was the reality. Because it's a place where perception matters more. It's not a place. I was going to say the good aspect of it is it brought back an aspect of New York that people were nostalgic for and had an experience, young people or younger people, which is a world in which you can meet someone and be invited. You can meet someone at a bar, at a coffee shop, and you can get invited into something that's cool or straddles elite and non-elite. Or it's glam. Maybe what Dimes is a place where you don't have to be truly elite to be glamorous and to be to have an edge and to have clout or to some kind of artistic reputation. I think it came about at a time of like peak institutionalism and peak normie conformity in culture, which is 2018, 2019, 2020, COVID. And COVID like burst that bubble. And so the invisible place that is Dimes Square, the attitude that is Dimes Square, became relevant and salient because things felt expensive and boring and dead. And it felt pointless to even try to climb any kind of ladder socially. And all of a sudden, there was a new bubble, which wasn't so hard to, which was easy, relatively easier to participate in and was decentralized. There wasn't a single, like, it wasn't in the sense that a New Yorker party is a centralized experience, a A24 party is going to be harder, you know, a rap party for, so elite media parties are harder to get into, but Dimes Square was a non-elite media party, a non-elite art party. Getting into the Svirner party, you know, Christmas party for the, or not, like getting into the Boghossian art party or Christmas party is going to be really hard. But Dimes was made up of dissidents from some people who were dissidents from the elite sphere that gave a kind of credibility to the energy that was surging from the bottom up. There are many other definitions, but that's more the sociology of it.
No, that makes sense. I think it feels more realistic in a way. I feel like you kind of touched on it, but why do you think people online are so obsessed with this social group? Because I feel like, from my own perspective, seeing the talk about it online, it just reminds me of the way like people idolized a show like Gossip Girl because it gave this like sense of community that's like lacking in your own life. Like you might live in the suburbs and it's really easy to absorb into this like parasocial city scene that seems like very far away. And
I
like,
think that's it. I think you just, that's
okay,
perfect.
cool.
You're perfect, Brittany.
Oh,
You
thank
can't be, you
you.
can't do better than that.
Yeah, no, I think it's like really, really fascinating to me because it's become a different thing than it is in person, I'm guessing, than it is in the online sphere and what it means to people online.
Yeah, I mean, even today, there are even like when we did this last run of the play, there are I would say they're like, I would leftist anons who are like, get him, like how dare people do this play, and then there's someone else who's like, no, I'm just like in New York and I liked it, it wasn't, and then there are also like rightist anons who are like, yeah, awesome, you know, like I want to be there, like I want to, and it's just, it's really, but those are both there's the, yeah, these parasocial obsessions with the scene, and but really whether it's a left inflected or a right inflected obsession with downtown, in the sense it's really an obsession with something that gets you out of your own, gets you out of your non-behavior. Actually, Dimes also represents a place where you can transform from in a non in a small town and into a person in a big town. And it's like this membrane through which you can, this portal through which you can pass with a new identity. And you can actually shed your identity and become someone new, which it happens. And I think that's one of the 2024 or 2025 version of this is exactly that. And I've met a lot of people who have remade themselves. They might have come to a scene party or a scene play or whatever with a certain version of themselves, and they leave with a new version of themselves that might be a total inversion of who they started as online. So I guess what I would say is that maybe I would go one step further and say the origin of the obsession is parasocial, but it also represents, because it's made so much up of people who had it began as parasocial observers and then transformed into social participants. It is this dime square becomes like a ritual placed to it's like the Ellis Island of New York socially, truly, where you can change your name at the port of call, and you can drop your normie townie self and become. And there's a lot of that in the play. There's a lot of people talking about home and the longing for home, because you don't forget really that you created yourself and you became a different person than who you really feel yourself to be for the sake of fitting in. And then there's also the line in the play about this is just a bit of more literary, more narcotic version of high school. And I think that's the irony of the scene, is that you realize, oh, it is actually just a version of high school. That's the same social structure as high school. And I'm not really fundamentally enjoying life. There's a chance that I don't actually tr I'm on the same relative place on the ladder that I was when I'm 17, but I'm now 27. Oh. And instead of like smoking weed with the cool kids, I'm like doing cocaine with the cool kids who also have book and TV deals. But I don't actually feel fundamentally better about myself, and I don't have more self-esteem than I have than one has had.
Yeah, speaking of the revival of Dime Square, because Brittany and I went to see it a couple weeks ago. And yeah, like I first just wanted to ask, because I thought it was so interesting coming into it from that perspective of, okay, we're like from Philly. We're not really like, we're not in New York. We don't really like know anything like personally, you know, about it. And so for us, it is just like the perception of it through the online space. And then just coming in to see this play. And then that perspective contrasting with the perspective of people who, I think you touched on this, just like random people who are in New York and just like go to see a play and they see Times Square and like their thoughts on it versus then people who are directly or indirectly involved with like the scene or who know people in the scene and are in the play. And so I'm curious for you, like, especially like with the revival, I don't know if it's different this time around, but how you've seen those different
Very different.
perceptions of the play, like vary.
It's very, very different. I think the first time, there's very little understanding of there being a difference between the inside and the outside of the play. And there were more seen people and behaviors in the cast. And also the scene was being defined at the time. And what I didn't realize is that the play would be a major part of defining the boundaries of the scene. That amorphous thing, and that the play would become a major event in Dime Square history and Dime Square lore. So even
Which
though I
must be
wanted,
so interesting as someone who wasn't in it at first to then like
true,
have
and I
that put
realized
you
that
in, yeah.
I basically created an island. It was like an artificial island, that just became part of the territory. So I became in it by proxy of creating just a territory that was then adjoined to the original scene. So there were some people who were like kind of originals, who were like, this is fake and this is not part of it, this is lame. And then there were people who were moving to New York after, and like many, many people who were like, 2022 was a time when a lot of young people were pouring into graduating, like really eager to break with COVID boringness, and like pouring into New York parties, even either visiting or moving here, like checking it out. And for them, the play was the most real version of Times Square. And the parties after the play and the places we did the play. And so it became part of the lore. And then there were a lot of rip-off versions of Times Square, parodies of the parody, rival plays, people doing indie theater the way that, like, Loft Theater, the way that I did it. And so then there became a whole subsidiary world of plays that were in some ways trying to repeat the success of my play. So a lot of things sprang out of it. And then so there was a lot of antagonism and tension, I think, tied up in that. Now it feels a lot more low key, knock on wood. It's like nice that the play is selling out, but also I don't have to, the cost of it is not having to see people being like, who's this guy? There's a tiny bit of that, but it's less, a lot less adversarial and parasocial. I think because the book was printed as a play, as it was part of a larger play collection, it was published. And it's also because I've done like 15 other of my plays, literally, and started a full-time theater company. And it's just, I've sort of, I think, just gone so far beyond the play myself, and intentionally, because I had a literary life and an intellectual and artistic life before the play, and I could not get stuck being the Dime Square playwright, even though I liked the play, and I think it's doing it again, I can really appreciate it. I think it's a very, I'm very proud of it, and I do think it is a kind of, it is like a definitive. Watching it again and directing it again, it does feel like a definitive statement on the social mechanics and the spirit of that, the early 2000s in New York. I have a lot more under, I have developed a self apart from the world, and that makes it a lot more fun for me to do. And I don't know, we've just had a lot of fun, and it's felt normal. It's felt like a normal play, and I've enjoyed that a lot. So
I really like what you said about it also, like just feeling like, oh, maybe high school isn't so different than doing coke with these cool people. And it's kind
yeah.
of the same thing. Interesting because while we were watching it, we just kept looking at each other and being like, oh my God. And like cringing at like certain lines, but like understanding it and it also having this like great like humor inside of it. It's like fun that people can relate without understanding it again. And I know that's like something we keep talking about, but I think it's very interesting. One last question specifically about Dime Square, and then we kind of wanted to get into just other stuff you've written and like some kind of like political stuff that's attached to just like the whole scene and like online stuff. But I did want to ask, and I know this was kind of a while ago, but I did want to ask about the criticism on the play. Because I know that this was kind of a large thing online, surrounding some Substack reviews specifically. I know Michael Crumpler wrote on Substack about how the scene feels like less about art and more about the people involved in it, and just about how it didn't like seem to look inward. And I was curious if you had like anything to say just in response to it, because it was just like a thing I think that set another perception on top of what people already thought. It was like, oh, this person's writing about this thing from the inside. And it just, I think, created this, like, it just like expanded on the parasocial thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Crumps had been in New York for 10 days or like 2 weeks at the time he wrote that, and he was dropping acid. Like we've been friends. I reached out to him a few weeks after that, after like a little bit of Twitter sniping, and I like we became friends, I think his view of the play is totally different than what it was then. And he's written about, and he, yeah, I mean, Crumps is a writer. He's like a, you know, he's dangerous in the sense that he doesn't, he will, like, Crumps is my friend, but no one should trust Crumps in the sense that he's going to always write what he's a very insightful psychoanalyst. He takes a lot of risks in his writing, and he's willing to kind of blow things up, figuratively. But I think so am I, and I think we found that we had that in common, and I think that he found he I he I can't speak for him, but I think he'd probably say that he found that our projects were closer together than he maybe originally saw. Yeah, I mean, there's not much to say. Like, I think that my work, it's a boring answer, but I just have to. I can only really answer like, online sniping through staying the course and continuing to, I kind of absorb those little sh micro shocks into my work, and into, I use it to try to further ironize my own writing and directing, and writing, essay writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the response to the play was actually, especially people who reviewed the collection, was very, very positive. But of course, it's the few negative things that tend to be repeated. And of course, outside of what's written down, there's a tremendous, I think the most negative aspects of it were actually un what wasn't written down. The social response was incredibly gossipy and negative. Things like the lore was so
Yeah.
much more toxic than the substacks. Like the substacks are incredibly tame compared to the unpublished, invisible tradition of Times Square gossip and backstabbing and all of which is in the play, but also is happening outside of the play, and the sense of artistic rivalries. I don't know. Yeah, the answer is I don't enjoy it, but you just you have to. I don't know. Like, what am I? I just power through, and I always try to think about whether something's true or fair, and then if it's not true or fair, I will try to respond in my own way.
No, I just
Yeah.
think his role in like everything that people saw online is interesting because it was like this look inside when no one actually knew what was going on. So like people,
Yeah.
I think, were like, oh, I can align with this perspective, or I can align with the perspective of like someone inside of it. And it's just like an interesting thing because it's very black and white. And I
Yeah, I
think,
mean, Crumps is a very dialectical. You should have him on. I mean,
we would love
yeah.
to.
Yeah. He's a very complex figure, I would say.
It's just interesting that he still seems relevant in some way, for in the same way kind of creating this timepiece around Times Square.
He's
And
yeah, he's relevant because
yeah.
he's a good writer. I think he got a lot of observations wrong, but he's a really good writer, and he has a, his he also fictionalizes, like he writes these like quasi-fictional, like I think what some people might not realize, he makes things up, he changes people's names, he changes things that happen, he just invents things. Like I became fully became a character in his Substack, some of which, and he would put true things in with just fictional things over time. But as I started to look better in his Substack, some of the people he was writing about got very mad at me for not getting the same treatment that they were getting, which is another funny phenomena. Like people getting mad at me for somehow getting a better fictionalized portrait of myself while they were getting a less flattering portrait of themselves in the Crumb stack. But what Crumbs was really doing was writing a novel in pieces. It was much more Bolaño-esque than I think. Was but yeah but there's so he survived because what you're right about that fascination it persists to this day, but he's also just a good poet and
Yeah. And what he's doing is pretty funny, honestly.
yes
Yeah.
yeah
Yeah.
yeah
No, the reason I brought that up was we were like at a movie showing recently, and like someone in the audience, like even after like it being like 2 years ago or something that he wrote that, like there, people are still asking about it, which I think is really
What was the movie?
interesting. It was RachelOrmont.com,
Okay.
the Peter Back
Yes.
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Part of the lore. Yes, you did all
Yes.
the tourist
Yeah, we had a little
attractions.
weekend.
Yeah.
We went around each place and we saw it with our own eyes.
It
It
was my
was
birthday weekend. It was the best birthday ever. Yep.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Wow.
Brittany.
Yep, no problem. Happy birthday, Queen.
Thanks.
Yeah. But yeah, to shift a little bit, we did want to touch on, do you want to ask about the Samira? Because I feel like you had like more thoughts about it. The like the culture in the Age of Trump write-up we thought was really interesting and like an interesting topic to talk about.
Read the one article or write-up called Culture in the Age of Trump, which basically, like a quick summary, was just kind of about like the election results and the reality of it. And I think like more generally, just like thinking about that, like this isn't really like what the article was about, but I think it kind of just like led like me to at least think about that and like this like uptick in this more like trad ideology that's largely influenced by the internet, it seems like, over the past like decade or so now. And who you talked about, like the public with Trump being bombarded with like a lot of negative info against
Yeah.
him. And I'm not sure if you want to like talk about this or not. If not, then that's totally fun too. But I was just curious, like
Yeah.
with that, and then like with also like because like the harmful stuff he has done, like grappling with those two sides, and like I don't know, just like because it does feel like there's like this movement kind of being spurred, not like in the article, but just that's being spurred apart from that of like very like radical, like, yeah, conservative, post-liberal, anti-woke, like kind of return to religious traditional values. And I'm just curious, like, about that.
My own politics. It's largely my own sense is that I'm still the same person at heart who grew up in the Bush administration years, saw the country going to, saw like the military, what we variously would call, what could be called the military industrial complex launching a lot of horrific wars, and just also seeing like larger infrastructural decline and demoralization. Like the world has felt worse and worse in many ways. And from my perception, much of the coalition against those things went over to the Republican side over the last really 2 years in particular. It's even accelerated in the last 6 months. And to me, those larger transformations in which the so what I perceive to be the anti-authority, anti-military industrial complex, like that energy and those like really was on the side of Trump this year, and I thought that was a complicated but overall exciting thing, because I just think on the macro scale that is going to have a much greater impact on people being alive or dead than anything else that we're talking about. More of the cultural differences, trad or progressive. So that's my own sense of things, because I think a lot of like this person's good, this person's evil, et cetera, is kind of much less relevant than are we engaged in a forefront war, funneling guns and weapons to foreign countries, cooing democratically elected leaders, or and stopping elections. Like those are the things that I care about. Now, is that what people talk about downtown? I don't think so. Yeah, I think that there's absolutely a very, very dark core to downtown culture, and I think that there are people who, I think Trump himself is kind of, again, this is my opinion, but I think he's more of a cipher, and I think there are many ways in which Trump will become what his, I think over the next 4 years, presumably, I think there's a lot that will be determined, but there is a dark kernel to some to this coalition. I think there are, like, again, exciting and good people who are part of this coalition. I think there are some really dangerous people who are part of this coalition. I'm comfortable with engaging with that complexity, but I will admit that I think you can see and you'll hear in certain conversations downtown, people who want something that approaches more of like a Bitcoin monarchy or a Bitcoin theocracy, and who have no problem with political violence. I've also written, I think this is true of the left in New York, and I find the glorification of violence, political violence, there's been an uptick of that over the last 4 or 5 years, and yeah, and it is part of the social currents and discourse you hear. I don't think that's a majority of people at all. I think the bigger question is if those people become glamorized or influential in ways, and some of them have been, and some of them may continue to be, and I think that's maybe where my own that's where I also try to have something to say, both in my work and in my playwriting and in my essay writing, that says no to that as well. But yeah, the short answer is I think it's complicated and ongoing, and it's not easy to tap dance your way to a position that doesn't feel bad.
Yeah, like very interesting because of like what we're living in now, where like where young people are getting their information from and where young people are getting different perspectives from and just hearing things. It's like seems almost impossible to explain to someone who isn't growing up in this generation or isn't growing up with the same influence of the internet to kind of explain like I don't know, it just feels like way more convoluted now than
Oh, I
before.
think so. Yeah, but that can be a good thing. I think the two-party world of the boomers, which was elegant and simple, was maybe too simple, and allowed a lot of injustice to all kinds of injustice to survive and thrive. And so there's a chaotic, anarchic, scary side to this breakdown of that coherence. But there's also hopefulness in that, in my, again, in my opinion. But I think that hopefulness is, and it's also scary because that implies a lot more personal responsibility. That implies that people have to not think in terms of memes and not think in terms of binaries and have conversations and develop social worlds and artistic projects and political projects that are not memeable, binary, stupid. And that requires a lot of like kind of constant attention, vigilance, willingness to change your mind, willingness to talk to people who you might not have talked to at a different time in that binary world. And so that's, yeah, so that could be a cause for pessimism or optimism. If you kind of believe in your pop, like I think I tend more to populism, and that I do think that ordinary people, whatever that, maybe that's its own form of idealism, really have a lot of wisdom, but and especially so when they're not hooked into cable news, and maybe also when people are not hooked into Twitter all the time. When information flows freely among people can have like there's no such thing as an unbiased conversation, but a
An open
nonprofit,
one.
yeah, an open one, then good things can happen. So I think just so much hinges, so much hint. In other words, I kind of see Trump as an opening a door, and what comes through the door could be really exciting, could also be really bad. But I do think we'd reached, I think in many ways we reached a point where that door was going to open, someone was going to open it. Because I think institutional power had grown so great that, well, I think COVID was so coercive and demoralizing that accelerated a timeline in which there was going to be some kind of populist reaction. So.
I know that you've been really vocal about like having no Wi-Fi in your apartment and also carrying around a flip phone. And I was curious if that kind of disconnect from the online space does have to do with politics for you.
Yeah, I mean, I still spend too much time. I have all these barriers set up to being online, but I still feel like I spend too much time. It's really just that. I think I'm very grateful to Twitter, your X, for the pandemic era. I think I've gotten a lot of really useful information from even the pre-Elon version and the post-Elon version. I've also got a lot of junk information, but especially when the pandemic hit, it helped me navigate my own life, and it helped me find people that I wanted to navigate that crisis with, and it helped me think about it. On the other hand, I know that it's made me dumber in certain ways. I know that it's made me more reactive, and I know that there are times, like there are days when I get something which proves to be really like true information. There are other days where I'm like freaking out about something that turns out to be false, or an exaggeration, or just a speculation, or it's just a total waste of my time. And I, as much as I like, I mean, I only have these like very minor like boundaries between myself and the internet because I know that it's addictive. So that's, I'm grappling with that kind of shame all the time.
Just filmed an episode kind of grappling with that issue of like being super overwhelmed by how much there is online, and then also like wanting to like know all of it at the same time, and it's like a very weird decision to like, seesaw between.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of seesawing. I think anyone, I don't know, I guess the best way people use the internet is to become more skeptical and tolerant and more open to changing their mind. And the worst way they use it is that we all use it is to become less open to changing our minds.
Yeah, I did kind of want to shift a little bit just to ask, just like about like 2025 as we're going into it, if you have like any projects or anything that you're like that you want to talk about. I know you had Zoomers come out earlier in January of this or I know.
I have two new plays. One is called Soonest Mended, and that's about a millennial married couple that opens up their marriage and the dates they go on. And so it's really a relationship drama, and we've workshopped that, and I'm really excited about that. That's going to be a much quieter, kind of humble production than I have, but I think really good. And then I have a play called Doomers, which is has nothing to relate, no relation to Zoomers, other than the kind of an inside joke about writing plays with that vowel sound. But that is about the night Sam Altman was fired at OpenAI, and so that is a probably my first and only tech play. And I'm still tweaking the second act, but it goes up in a month or 6 weeks, 5 weeks. And that was written about in the Times already, because we did a lot of developmental readings, and it's a yeah, I'm engaging with AI and with AGI. And with Sam Altman as a character, it's fictional. It's totally fictional. I make up things like Crumps. I make up things that I did a lot of research. I interviewed a lot of people, but I'm also,
Having fun.
Yeah. You said it's your only play about tech, you think, like that you're ever gonna
Well,
do,
I'm gonna
or
need. I say that. I mean, I might. It depends on how much tech becomes in a sense,
I
the
think that's
world.
what Elon Musk said once.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it might just become so part of our world that there is no such thing as a tech play. There's just a naturalism might just be a tech play. So we'll see.
I know you mentioned that you feel you've become accomplished through being a playwright, but also that it's not as financially rewarding. And I'm curious what you do to sustain yourself in New York since it's a hard thing.
I'm a tutor. Yeah, I'm a tutor. Yeah, I mean, I do make more income from writing than I used to, which when it used to be zero, now it's some percentage of my, but it's not from theater. So I don't, my own theater space, I really don't take any money from that because I have to put it back into paying the rent on the space. I might like charge like dinners and lunches with other theater, like theater meetings to the company card, but that's like the exception of like, and I teach classes through the theater company, but even that gets rolled back into paying the space rent.
No, we saw when we were there that, there's just like a lot of workshops and classes and stuff going on
Yeah.
that, just seemed very cool to
No,
just like
it's a
see.
wonderful, like it's an amazing thing, but so much of, yeah, that is not really paying for my life. It's at best maintaining my ability to work there, which is to like have that space, which is again an awesome benefit, but it is not a basic need because it's I don't live there at the BCTR. So
Someone does normally live there.
no,
Okay, not
it's a curse.
anymore.
It's no, no one's ever lived. My
Okay.
old spaces were a mixture of tenants and the, and that was a disaster. So yeah,
Okay.
I want to only work at commercial spaces.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
Yeah.
In terms of being a tutor, I
Yeah.
am curious because we're like talking a lot about online things, changing people's politics and stuff. And I know that literacy is a big part of just like what's changing because of online technology. I'm curious if you've seen a decline at all
Oh
with
my
like
God,
students.
yeah, how could I not see it? Yeah, no, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming, and the consequences of that are world altering.
How do you feel like
So
you like wage the gap there, like when teaching people and it being like just like a completely different thing that you're probably having to teach now?
Do you tutor like kids also, but or like how
have
old?
arranged this year. I've gotten a lot more fifth graders who are applying to gifted schools for writing. So the other thing is there's a major stratification. So the kids and the teenagers who do read at a really high level and do write at a really high level, and then the ones who don't at all. Like they're barely literate. So I think that's going to be the trend, and you can sort of see that even on with your gen, like people in their 20s. There's like more obsession with the literary world and literature and books, maybe than ever. But there's nothing beyond that. Like the drop off is incredibly steep. There are kids who cannot write well enough to prompt ChatGPT.
That's
Like they,
crazy. I saw
yeah.
this Twitter thread of like this teacher and just talking about like all the different ways that she is experiencing like or witnessing it in the kids that she teaches. And just reading it was an insane thing because I feel like very removed from that, not being in college anymore or not like really being around kids like at least at that level. And so yeah, I'm very like fascinated to like talk to anyone who is a teacher, is a tutor,
A lot
and
of teachers don't
see.
read either, so the decline is multi-generational. Teachers are less literate and less interested in non-YA. They're mostly just teaching. Most teachers just teach YA
Yeah.
and they read YA, and so there's
That's crazy.
No, it's insane because I remember being a kid and being like reading fanfic while also, being in school reading like classics. And I think that's just a very interesting thing because I feel like as a kid, I was like, please let us read a YA novel, like that's what you want as a kid, but it's like the easy thing and it's like not actually what's helpful.
No, something really terrible has happened, and but it's terrible because it's not relevant to whether people can live their lives. So, in other words, like, this can all happen and life will go on and AI will just do the things we can't do, and all of the things that come with all the internal benefits that come with being a literate, a deeply literate person, and having like being cultured. It's not all pros and all cons,
Yeah,
but
of course.
I do think like a mixed economy, a mixed mental economy is probably best. But we're not really talking about people who did teach themselves to read or did invest in classics while also using social media. We're talking about kids who, like millions and millions of teenagers, who can't watch a movie without subtitles. Can't focus on a movie for an hour and a half. Can't watch it without subtitles in their native language, and can't write a complete sentence, and have never read a book in their lives. Like, that's really what we're talking about. And
I haven't heard that about subtitles before. That's really interesting.
oh, really? That's a big, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't
I
know
know.
that
I
that was
think
like
that was,
a.
yeah, one of the things that the teacher was like talking about also.
I didn't like realize that had like that makes sense that it would have to do with attention. I just like didn't put that together. That's interesting. But I am curious just as like a final question, because you're a teacher, I'm wondering if you what you suggest as a solution. I know it's a huge question and maybe you don't even have one, but I am curious because I think it's important to kind of just like grapple with, okay, well, what can we do to fix this thing?
Everything has to be by pen and paper. It's really, I think it's that simple. Like, technology needs to be completely removed from the classroom, and schools need to be zones where actually people can learn as if it were 1900. Like, schools need to become havens of safety from toxic technology, and teachers themselves have to kind of own up to the shame of being less literate themselves and less capable of teaching. There's just kind of needs to be a total reevaluation. Smaller schools, kids need healthier food, like way healthier food, and more nature. Like, I imagine like schoolhouses on farms, and in cities, like in nicer places. Like, we need to break up big education, in my opinion.
If you like think it's possible or if like to do that or if you like you think we will get to that point.
It's possible. I don't think there's the social will to do that. I'd be shocked if that actually happens. But you know what? If you can't articulate, you can't articulate the goal, then there's no chance of it happening. I think that there's some version of that, or some, even if like 100,000 kids get a different kind of education, that's enough to pass. It's all like pass along the torch of culture, of civilization. Also, like, there might be life extension. There might be like our whole sense of what the future is going to be. There's so many different outcomes over the next 10 or 15 years, the next 10 months, that education is just, in my opinion, is one piece of that puzzle. But yeah, I think we have to put soul. I mean, my opinion, there's like, we have to start thinking of kids as having souls, and like, what would you want a soul to have is going to be really different than what would you want to have. It's really different than everything pointing towards your future resume.
No, I always think it's very interesting hearing like anyone older who comes on talk about their perspective on the like just what the internet has done because it's just like such a different thing for people who have actually lived a partial life without it, even though we kind of did too, but just like in a way different way.
No, and I think I think the way to reform schools is, I've seen things posted on Twitter. This is a good like example of social media meshing with a sort of a trad mentality, but like education influencers posting curriculums from like equivalent to middle school in 1900, and college students could not do middle school homework from a 19th century schoolhouse. And so a lot like same with like recipes for food, like a lot of old recipes are healthier and better, and we can do the same thing for education. We can go back and look at those old recipes and just cook from them. The recipes will work the same way. That's the beautiful thing about classics and about knowledge is that they don't change, we change. And food doesn't change. We our way of preparing food has changed, eating food has changed.
Yeah, no, I saw something in that or online where they were saying something about how there was like a shift from teaching like phonetic like reading, yeah, to
To
I
whole word based.
yes, yeah, and how it's been very like very harmful and like one of like very bad for I like don't know enough about it to like speak on it. I just saw online, but
No, I think that's it. It's teachers, it's basically a way of going faster. So rather than sounding out words syllable by syllable and just developing a huge mental lexicon of syllabic, sounds, whole, I don't, I mean, I'm not a phonetics. This is where I don't have the vocabulary for it, but just asking them to get, they're basically teacher just asking them to guess what the word means based on the first syllable. And that's going to be really different than just repeatedly going through words and developing a much more, as much as full word learning sounds like it's more holistic, it's less. It's basically the cognitive equivalent of autocomplete. But the
That's really
English is really,
scary.
yeah.
Like the doom surrounding that is
Yeah.
crazy. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and for
Yeah.
talking about your experience, like as a teacher, as a playwright, just in internet things that people look at. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just have one more thing. We have all of our guests
Yeah.
do a thing. If we could just
Yeah.
send it in chat, have you repeat it. We have everyone request a guy. It's
Request
just
a guy.
yeah, it's just like
Yeah.
a little fun thing that we do. It's our fun thing.
Yeah. It's not so fun
Not
anymore,
so
but
fun anymore.
we're
We
still
have
doing it. Example.
yeah, so we just have someone read that out and request Josh Ovaya because we're trying to get him on the podcast. So we're making everyone like hound him.
Oh, yeah, request. Oh, crumps. Request crumps. Easy.
Oh
Super
yeah,
easy.
crumbs.
Did I get requested?
No.
No, we're having like
Wait,
everyone
everyone
request
requested
the
like
same
one
person.
person. Yeah, it's in the chat, Joshua Baye.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
It'd
I you
be
want Oh, okay.
But
Yes, I do
requesting
that
crumbs
too.
sounds like a great idea
I
too.
think we should
Like
request crumbs.
we
That's
can
okay.
do both,
Yeah.
yeah. If you
Yeah.
wanna just add them in there.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
am I supposed to say that?
Yeah. Sadly,
Okay.
yeah.
I request Mike Crumplar and that other guy, Josh.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for
Bye.
chatting with us. It was really
It's nice
interesting.
meeting you both. We'll text separately about the play stuff, okay?
Yeah,
If you want.
sure. We would love to set that up. I think it'd be really fun for Philly people to get because we don't really
Yeah.
have that
Yeah, I think so
much.
too. I have some ideas.
Okay.
Cool. Sounds
Well, nice
fun.
to meet you. Nice to
Bye.
talk to
Likewise.
you. Have a lovely
Yeah.
day.
Ciao. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.